Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Kagyu Path, Refuge, Vows, and Transmissions by Lama Kathy Wesley. In this talk in our series describing the Kagyu Path, Lama Kathy outlines the vows taken by aspiring Dharma students and the unique Buddhist concept of transmission, in which teachers give students more than just the words of a vow or practice, but open a door to a new way of seeing the world. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, I'm so delighted that you've had an opportunity to come here today. I feel honored on days like today, because who would have thought all those years ago when I was growing up here in Columbus that I would be at a Buddhist center in downtown Columbus talking to people about things that are important. And it's a very gratifying and wonderful thing. And I just want to thank all of you for all that you do to keep this this place running and operating. And all of you who bring your sincerity here every single week. You bring your sincerity here. You bring your wish to be people who are consciously living, and not living unconsciously, but living consciously, and being of benefit, not just to yourself, but others. So all of you have a story, and I know some of them, but all of you have a good heart, and you're bringing it here each and every week, and filling this space with your good intention. And I just wanna thank you for that, because it's a special thing that I sometimes take for granted, but I appreciate. So just like, thank you for being you, and thank you for being here. Before we start today's talk, we'll do a little prayer. This is commonly done in Tibetan Buddhism at the beginning of something, when we are going to undertake something or begin something. We call upon the Buddha as our teacher and our example. We call on his teaching, the Dharma, as our guidebook. And we call on the Sangha who gather with us as our community. And we take refuge in these three jewels as a way of acknowledging our own Buddha potential and making an aspiration that we ourselves will follow in the same path as the Buddha. So we'll recite this two times in English, and then one time I'll give my best to chant in Tibetan. So here we go. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. O Sanje Chudon Soji Chonamla Jang Chu Pardu Tani Kyap Suchi Daji Chin Soji Besunam Ki Drola Penchir Sanje Drupasho. Okay. I'll start with another short prayer of my own. Oh, Palen Sai Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chiwar Pede Tenshala Kadren Jembo Gone Che Sun Te Kusun Tugging Udrup Sal Du So. Okay, thanks again. Well, today's topic is a continuation of a topic that I spoke about a few weeks ago, which is the path of the Karma Kagyu lineage. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that there are so many different aspects of Buddhism. There's so many different types of Buddhism. Schools and so forth, and each of them has a lineage that goes back to the historical Buddha Shakyamuni himself. And these lineages, all of them attribute their beginning to the enlightened one himself, the Buddha, and that he taught his disciples and some of his disciples became enlightened. And then those disciples, becoming enlightened, taught their disciples, and so on and so forth, through the entire history of Buddhism. So that's why I like to talk about Buddhism as a living lineage. It's like one candle lighting another through history. And so that every generation, there are beings who accomplish awakening and then go on to help others as well. And we all possess this potential, this Buddha potential, and that if we can practice as the Buddha taught, that we then can realize that Buddha potential and become awakened beings ourselves. And so there's a little bit about lineage that has to do with it being tried and true. It's something that we have tried and we've worked with and tried the methods and techniques of Buddhism, and we have found them to be true for us. Maybe we struggle a bit with shamatha meditation, for example. You know, maybe as we sit on our meditation cushion and we're watching the breath come in and go out and come in and go out, we have moments of, you know, fantasy, distraction, being somewhere else. But if we remember the technique, we can bring our attention back to the breath again and restore ourselves to a moment of mindful awareness. And knowing that that potential exists every moment is a powerful thing. That no matter where we are and no matter what state of mind we're in, we do have the potential to bring ourselves back to our present moment of awareness and goodness. And this present moment of our basic goodness, which some people call Buddha nature. And so we can do that. We can bring it back and bring it back and bring it back at any time. And that's a powerful thing. And I also talked about the history of our Karma Kagyu lineage. Ka, which is the first letter of the Tibetan alphabet, as it happens, it means word. It's a word that means word in Tibetan. Ka, K-A. It's the first letter of the Tibetan alphabet, but it also means word, and specifically it means like the word of the Buddha. It also carries the connotation of a command, like a powerful word from the ruler and, you know, from the monarch or some such. And so this idea of the Ka, G-Y-U, as we spell it in English letters, means lineage. The lineage of the spoken word. The lineage of the words of the Buddha. That particular, while Buddhism as a whole is 2,600 years old, our lineage, our particular lineage, starts 1,000 years ago when the great Buddhist master Tilopa had accomplished his own awakening. After having studied with 100 human teachers, he meditated and meditated deeply and well and attained Buddhahood. And when he attained enlightenment, he had a vision, of the Buddha Shakyamuni, who had lived centuries before. Shakyamuni appeared to him in the form of the Buddha Vajradhara, brilliantly blue like the sky, and that he spoke to Talopa and gave him brief, concise, essential instructions on how to achieve awakening through the practice of something that came to be known as Maha Mudra. Maha means great, mudra means, there are lots of meanings to the word mudra, but the one in this case is seal, like the seal of authenticity on a document. Sometimes I think instead of calling it great seal or Maha Mudra, we could call it great authenticity, because it has to do with the authentic, true nature of our minds. And so these essential teachings that Talopa received in a vision from the Buddha have been passed down generation, spiritual generation after spiritual generation for 1,000 years. And they have come to us through our lineage of masters who lived in Tibet. Talopa, who lived in India, taught another Indian master named Naropa. And Naropa gained awakening, and then he taught the next spiritual generation, the Tibetan translator Marpa, who had come to India to get the Dharma and take it back to his homeland. Once he got back to his homeland, Marpa gave these teachings to Milarepa, his student, a remarkable poet who became a saint. And Milarepa then gave it to his disciple, Gampopa, a great physician who had suffered tragedy and become a monk, and after becoming a monk, became a great scholar and a physician. And then Gampopa used these teachings, these essential teachings, became enlightened, and then taught his student, Dusum Kempa, who became known as the first Karmapa. And that for the next 17 spiritual generations, the Karmapas have continued, and their heirs, you know, the Karmapas and their spiritual heirs, have held these essential teachings of Maha Mudra and given them to each successive generation. I received them from Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, who had been sent to the United States in the 1970s by His Holiness the 16th Karmapa to establish Buddhist centers here in America. So my teacher, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, the founder of this center, designed, if you will, he designed a method for teaching the Karma Kagyu lineage here in America. And it followed the advice of the 16th Karmapa, who gave the, outline of our teaching and training program when he gave us our name. Because the name of our center, Karma Taiksam Choling, is the same name as the name he gave to his national organization, Karma Triyana Dharma Chakra. Karma means we're of the Karma Kagyu lineage. Triyana, or Taiksam, means three vehicles, or the three vehicles of the Buddhist teaching, or the three types of Buddhist teaching. Sometimes known as the three yanas, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. But you could also call it by a different name, the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma that the Buddha gave during his lifetime. So whether you call it a yana or a wheel turning, we have three. Our Hinayana practice is based in ethics, morality, and self-awareness. We practice shamatha as our basic practice of the Hinayana. And we practice vows and precepts to help us with our aim in life and our behavior toward ourselves and toward others. I jokingly say that in the Hinayana, we're working on understanding our mind, understanding how our mind accumulates habits and karma, and how to begin to sweep and clean our karma a bit by changing what we think, what we say, and what we do from something that's negative to something that's positive. And our Mahayana practice here at KTC is the practice of compassion meditation. Because in the Mahayana Sutras, the Buddha taught the indispensability of love and compassion as a powerful force for transforming the mind. He said, shamatha meditation is just the beginning. Quieting the mind is just the start. That we can eventually train the mind as well as tame the mind. We start with taming, and then we train the mind. And what do we train it in? We train it in something called bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakening, and citta means mind. So bodhicitta is like the mind that wants to wake up. And the techniques are love and compassion. So by learning compassion meditation as our second practice, we're able to change our way of looking at things. That it is hopefully a little less selfish and hopefully a little more kind and generous to everyone. The third practice we learn here are the practices of something called the Vajrayana. Vajra means, actually it has several different meanings, but it means indestructibility. The connotation is of a diamond that can't be destroyed. The idea is that only a diamond can cut another diamond, you know, that analogy. But that it is indestructible. And it's called the indestructible jnana because in that practice, we deal with mind itself. Mind itself examines itself and learns about itself and practices itself. And that practice is summarized with the two words maha mudra. So that is what we practice as our Vajrayana practice. We practice maha mudra in several ways, including through mantra meditation, such as the mantras we did today of Medicine Buddha and Chenrezig, which we do weekly on Tuesday evenings. And so by teaching these mantra practices as well as teaching what is called the Maha Mudra Preliminary or Nundro, we guide students along the path of the three jhanas. So that was this is a summary of what I've talked about so far. Today I wanted to emphasize a bit and talk a bit about vows, precepts, and empowerment. Because these are things that you will see happening at a Dharma center like ours, but you may not know what they are or what they mean. And so this Kagyu path is partially accomplished through teaching, such as teaching about karma, teaching about basic meditation, teaching about compassion meditation, teaching about mantra, teaching about the practices of the Maha Mudra preliminaries or Nundro. Now, some of it's accomplished through teaching, but some of it is accomplished through practice. And the practices are rooted in the history of Buddhism. For example, today, after this talk is over, we're going to be doing the first of the vow ceremonies that are done in our tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, that we will be giving what is called the vow of taking refuge. For many people, this is the beginning of their Buddhist path. And it's the very first vow that they take as they become a Buddhist. The word Buddhist is very interesting in Tibetan. We think of it as just a label, but the connotation of the word in Tibetan, the word for Buddhist in Tibetan, means insider, a person who is concerned with the inner life, not a person who's worried about the outside life, but is really into their inner life, understanding and grasping their inner being and their spiritual potential and working with that. So I find that really interesting. When Kempo Kartha Rinpoche first started talking about this meaning, he said, now I know that many of you think of insiders as people who have secret information, who use it for their own benefit. He said, we're not that kind of insider. You know, it's not a secret handshake kind of thing. It's, you know, it's about being concerned with the inner life. And so that the vow of refuge consists of a person coming before an image of the Buddha, which we have here on our shrine, and in front of a teacher who has themselves received the refuge vow and kept it. And then the person who is seeking refuge says, I, and they give their name, say, from now until enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddha, the transcendent conqueror, the greatest of all human beings. I take refuge in the Dharma, that is peace and nirvana, meaning a cessation to suffering, peace and nirvana, the greatest of all that is free from attachment. I take refuge in the Sangha, those who are beyond turning back, the greatest of all communities. Master of this ceremony, please accept me as a Buddhist and a holder of these three refuges. So in this way, a person sets foot on the Buddhist path in a formal way, and by saying in front of the Buddha, I take you, Buddha, as my teacher, the Dharma, your Dharma as my path, and your Sangha as my Sangha community. And then afterward, the person then recites and keeps the refuge vow every day by reciting a short vow, and in fact, it is this one that you just read, in the morning and the evening, every single day, for the rest of their lives. And they do this as a way of reminding themselves what's important. As Siddhartha Rinpoche said, you're stating your direction. You know, he said, destination Buddhahood. You know, that's what you're saying when you take refuge. You're proclaiming your direction. Then, usually what will follow that in our training as Buddhists, after the vow of refuge, some time may pass, and a person may choose to take what are called the five precepts of the lay practitioner. And these are vows of conduct that are not required, interestingly enough. They are not required for people to take them. But many people choose to take them as a way of increasing their mindfulness. Because if you've promised not to do something, you're going to be watching yourself to keep your own promise, you know, to keep your own word to yourself. And so, you know, so that's, I guess you could call it the energy of vow keeping, is this awareness, cultivating a mindfulness of our conduct and how our conduct impacts not just ourselves, but others. And you'll find them very easy to remember because they're very familiar to you. No killing, no stealing, no lying, not committing moral misconduct or sexual misconduct. And then the last one is not taking intoxicating substances. These first four are called the root vows. The fifth one is called a branch vow, because by keeping the vow of not taking intoxicating substances, one can more easily keep the previous four. Kempo Kartha Rinpoche used to encourage people to take all five. In fact, near the end of his life, He went so far as to not give the vow ceremony except for people who wished to take all. But really, a person could take just one. And people say, well, you know, are they hard to keep? Well, you know, the not killing one, it's kind of easy, but kind of not easy. You know, it's kind of easy, but kind of not easy, because the way there are ways to, how shall we say, bend the vow or contravene the vow without fully breaking it. And so that means if you have to call pest control for your house, you've got some death on your hands. But what can you do? People would go to Kempo Rinpoche, and who was a very pragmatic man. He was born in Tibet in 1924. He was old school in all of the different ways a person could be old school. But he was very pragmatic. So people would come to him and say, well, you know, we have to spray our home for bugs. But I feel really bad because I took the precept not to kill. And Rinpoche would say, well, what can you do? What can you do? He said, it depends on whether you can live with those bugs or not. He said, if leaving the bugs there will degrade your health or the health of your family, then you better do something. He said, but you don't have to like it. You don't have to be happy about it. So he encouraged us to do prayers for all of the insects we kill before the fact and after the fact. We have to kind of take responsibility for it. A buddy of mine, after he took the precept not to kill, he was working in a classroom. And before air-conditioned schools, they were, of course, open air. You would open the windows and bugs would come in. And a hornet got into his classroom one day and was wreaking havoc and terrifying the students, dive-bombing the students and so forth. And so he had to do that old-fashioned thing of taking a wad of syllabuses or syllabi, he smacked and killed the hornet. He said, I'll tell you, he said, afterwards he said to me, you know, it's tough to be a Buddhist. And he said, before I became a Buddhist, I wouldn't have thought anything of that. I wouldn't have thought a single thing about killing that hornet. In fact, I would have been all excited about it. He said, but now I'm realizing that when I kill something, that impacts me. That affects who I am. And, you know, he said, you know, this being a Buddhist isn't easy sometimes. Just not easy. But it's not that the Buddha wanted to make things tough for us. It was that he wanted us to be mindful and take responsibility for what we think, what we say, and what we do. And that's the whole idea behind all of the precepts. Not killing, not stealing, not lying, not committing sexual misconduct, and not taking intoxicating substances. All of these things can be purified, so we don't have to worry too much, but because we've promised not to do these things, when we do them, we do have to make sure that we go to the Buddha and say, well, Buddha, I messed up. And there actually is a Buddhist practice of confession. I know it's weird. So many people come to Buddhism from Christianity and say, oh, I thought I left all of that behind. But you've got it too? You have confession too? And I say yes, but not to a person. You can confess to the Buddha. And in fact, it's a good idea if you talk to him every day, because then you're keeping up with what's going on in your thoughts and your actions. You're keeping up with yourself. You're not letting yourself fall into bad habits over and over again. So the taking of precepts while voluntary is something that people do in order to deepen their experience of mindfulness, because they're then watching their behavior and reporting on it to the Buddha every day. There's a habit that some of the masters of the past have done is that they start with a pile of stones and two bowls. One bowl is good karma, the other bowl is bad karma. And they put a stone in each bowl at the end of the day and see which bowl had more of it in it. And then they rejoice in all the good things they've done. They rejoice, which I think is cool, because it isn't all about feeling guilty for the bad things you did. I mean, a little bit of guilt is okay, but too much guilt, we have to watch out for that too, because that puts us out of balance. So we take responsibility for the negative things we do. We say prayers, asking the Buddha to purify them. We actually recite the names of 35 Buddhas. It's a confession liturgy that has come to us from Indian Buddhism. The names of these 35 Buddhas are said to be purifying. So a person confesses in front of the 35 Buddhas and then and regrets their wrong and purifies it through reciting these Buddhas' names. And in fact, my teacher said, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche once said, there's only one good thing about bad karma, and that's that it can be purified. It's just relative truth, so it can be changed. But we also, at the end of the day, rejoice in the good that we have done, and we say, I will do more of that, which I like, because just feeling bad about bad stuff and not giving ourselves credit for actually doing a few good things, I mean, that's out of balance. So it's really nice that we include rejoicing in the good that we have done. But keeping of the precepts and the keeping of refuge is not the end of the path for us. We have two more things that we can, practices that we can engage in. One of these is the Bodhisattva commitment, taking the commitment of the Bodhisattva to work for the benefit of suffering beings from now until one attains enlightenment. Spoiler alert, even after you attain enlightenment, you're going to be working for the benefit of beings. I'm sorry, there's no way off that bus once you get on it. But the idea is that we say, until enlightenment is reached, we will train as the Buddhas of the past have trained in love and compassion and bodhicitta. And so when a person takes the bodhisattva vow, they again go in front of a Buddha image and in front of a teacher who has held the vow, and they say that from then, that moment, until they attain enlightenment, they will practice the perfect virtues of generosity and patience, ethics, meditation, diligence, and wisdom. And so by practicing these six perfect virtues, they will uncover their Buddha nature and gain enlightenment just as the Buddhas of the past have done. And if you think it was hard to keep the no-killing vow, when the Bodhisattva vow has to do with our motivation. So that means if we just look ugly at somebody, give them the side eye, or think hateful thoughts toward them, this is actually not a breaking of the Bodhisattva vow, but it's definitely a bending or a contravention of that vow. And so we also have to look at that every day. So it's one thing to police, you know, to police our own activity, but policing our own motivation, ooh, that's another level of magnitude. It's another level of difficulty. But yet, being able to look at our mind and honestly say, I am thinking this, I am doing this, this is my motivation, is such a powerful thing. To take the awareness, not just of the things we do with our bodies and speech, but also with our mind. Where are we going with our intention? How can we trade selfish intention for unselfish intention over and over and over again? That is the purpose of the Bodhisattva vow, to fine-tune that motivation and make it as good as possible. And finally, the order of magnitude increases with Vajrayana empowerment. You see, the refuge vow and the ethical precepts are part of the Hinayana path. They sometimes call it the common vehicle. The love and compassion practice is the Mahayana, the great vehicle. And then the practice of mantra and visualization and so forth is called the indestructible vehicle, the practice of the indestructible vehicle. And so these practices increase our practice of awareness, self-awareness, and our mindfulness and our self-awareness increase, starting with the refuge, taking refuge in the Buddha instead of in other things. The precepts, taking the Buddha's behavior as our behavior, and so on, and then taking responsibility for that on a daily basis, and then through the Mahayana Bodhisattva vow, taking responsibility even for our attitude, moment to moment. But then, when we take Vajrayana empowerment, challenge is even bigger, but at least they give you something that is really fun to do. They ask you when you receive a Vajrayana empowerment to practice thinking of yourself as a Buddha. You just practice it. It's not happened yet, but you practice the idea that you take on a visualization of yourself as being one of the Bodhisattvas or one of the Buddhas as a temporary training while you're sitting on your seat. But then if you really want to practice the promise you make in the when you receive an empowerment, you'll be thinking of that Buddha or Bodhisattva anytime, all day long. My friends who grew up in the Catholic tradition will know what a patron saint is. You know, it's a saint whose life you admire and who you take to be your example. Well, there are patron Buddhas and patron Bodhisattvas in Tibetan Buddhism. That was how they talked about them back in the old days when scholars were struggling to understand what made Tibetan Buddhism different. So when a person receives an empowerment, it's like receiving a vow in that you receive what's called a transmission, which is something more than words being said over you. Your intention and the master of the ceremony's intention are supposed to be in sync so that whatever goodness came to the master from that their master and from their master and from their master comes to us when we receive it from the vow. We receive the words of the vow, but a little something more. That little something more, you could call it inspiration. You could call it the secret sauce. I don't know. The idea is that you receive the support, the spiritual support of someone who wants you to succeed, and you feel that that's with you all the time. That's really what transmission is, when the master gives us these vows and blesses us with implements and statuary, when he's giving us a Vajrayana empowerment, or when he or she is giving us a Vajrayana empowerment, the teacher again represents the Buddha or Bodhisattva of that empowerment and blesses us with an image of that Buddha, a text of that Buddha's mantra, and so forth, and just blesses us with all of these objects to give us confidence that we can visualize ourselves as that Buddha, and we have permission to visualize ourselves as that Buddha or Bodhisattva and use that Buddha or Bodhisattva's form and mantra as a method for seeing our own Buddha nature. Sometimes we have to use symbols and symbolic means to recognize something that is otherwise a little hidden from us. And so the transmission that happens in an empowerment is similar to the transmission that happens in all of these vow ceremonies, refuge, precepts, bodhisattva, and so on. It's very similar in that it's a joint intention of the master giving the empowerment and the disciple receiving it, that they will then take on this practice to benefit others. Now, I did all right. I got through all three of them. Speaking extemporaneously is something that I need to do because my eyesight's not so good. So reading is becoming a little challenging for me. But I'm hopeful that this exposition about vows, precepts, and empowerments is helpful to you in understanding why these types of vow ceremonies are given by a Dharma center like ours. We give them, I guess you could say, as a way of helping beings connect to the teachings, connect to the practices, and use those teachings and practices and encourage them to use those teachings and practices on themselves, to transform themselves the way the Buddha wants us to transform ourselves, from confusion to awakening. Because this is, to me, the coolest thing about Buddhism, is that every being has Buddha nature. Every being has inherent value and inherent worth that they don't have to earn. And that if we can recognize this inherent value that we have, our Buddha nature, we will begin to respect ourselves more and also to feel for and respect others, because others are struggling. They don't know they have Buddha nature. They don't know it. And because they don't know it, they do all kinds of things that are harmful. So I think I'll stop here, because I want there to be time for discussion if people have questions or curiosities about this topic. As it happens, after this talk, there will be a refuge ceremony that's being given. And if you wish to take a short break of 5 minutes or so after the talk is over, you can sit in and either renew your refuge vow if you're a previous, yeah, we call them refugees. It's really not, it's not funny. But if they want to renew their refuge vow, they can return to do that, or just observe if they wish. So anyway, let's see, what types of things do people want to talk about? We have our microphone here. By the way, I want to thank the crew here, Julaine and the rest of the crew. Don was here yesterday and Helder was here yesterday. They were all rearranging the chairs for Lama Tom's program, and I kind of like it. So, yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I do the 7-branch prayer, and part of that is confession.
Yeah.
So, is there, do practitioners, when do they decide to do the longer 35 Buddha one versus like
the short ones?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, you know, he both understood how busy we were and kind of rebelled against it a little bit, kind of pushed back a little bit. So on one hand, he would give us short prayers to do, but then he would encourage us to do the longer ones, you know, under the guise of like putting energy into our practice, you know, but for some of us, it's just too much. The 35 Buddha prayer takes about 5 to 7 minutes to recite. It could be a little longer, maybe, you know, somewhere between 5 and 8 minutes to recite. And there's a lot, you know, and you can do it in English, which is makes it better, right? Because you just name all the Buddhas. And they have really amazing names, like, you know, Moonlight and things like that. But what Kempo Rinpoche did near the end of his life was he said that the 7-branch prayer that you spoke about, which is very short and can be recited in less than 60 seconds, you know, it's really short, does contain a confession. And if you sit and reflect on your day before you recite the 7-branch prayer and have the intention in your mind that you regret your wrong and that you rejoice in the good things that you've done, because regret and rejoicing are both in the 7 branches. Then that's a really good thing to do. But he says, once a person has taken the Bodhisattva vow, he really encouraged people to do the 35 Buddhas, because he says it comes from the Sutra tradition and it's more powerful. Now, I don't always do that. But I really strongly recommend to myself. I just thought, you know, I'm having a moment. I strongly recommend to myself that I start reciting the 35 Buddhas again, because he said, you know, he says it's one thing to tell your master that you goofed up. He said, but you really should be talking to the 35 Buddhas every day. And he says it's a very powerful prayer. But he also then he said for your Bodhisattva vow, 35 Buddhas, because it's from the Sutra tradition. He said, yes, there's a much shorter practice called the Mantra of Vajrasattva, which purifies all kinds of negativity. And it's a very short mantra that you could recite with a visualization. He said, but then I think he was really pressing me in particular, because he knew how lazy I am. And so he really strongly recommended the 35 Buddha prayer. So I was typing up, because I'm that kind of a weirdo, I just like to type stuff up, type notes from teachings and stuff. So I was typing up the notes from Kempo Rinpoche's instructions on how to keep the Bodhisattva vow, and guess what? He put the 35 Buddhas in there. And so as a way, I think, of just keep pushing me a little bit.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. See, you know, here I go again. Other things that people might want to ask about. That's all right. Hey, we got a little time. We got another few minutes.
I was the first one in here. I think it's 11:15.
I appreciate that.
I have to stretch my legs, so.
Sure, sure.
This is a false question.
Sure.
Set that chair and give these folks a little more time to think of a question.
Sure. Oh, God love you. Thank you so much. You're the best. You know, he performed a service to mankind just now. Thank you. Or humankind. Thank you very much. That was very nice of you. Thank you. He bought you some time, audience. Well, yeah. We got a couple of customers. Oh, we got three customers. Okay, this'll finish the morning. All right. Morning, sir. Good to
Morning.
See you. Good to see
Morning.
You.
Yeah. I just wanted to share a thing that I do at my house to take care of the bugs. Mm-hmm. And I have an accumulation of spiders to reside in my house.
All right.
And periodically I have to go around and sweep up the thoraxes of insects that they've
unlucky bugs
that they've collected and consume the contents of their bodies, and then periodically, maybe once or twice a year, one of the spiders will misbehave and bite me in my sleep. But then I get a talking to, and they calm down for another year or so. It keeps the exterminator away from my house.
I really appreciate you sharing. Thank you.
You're welcome. The other thing I won't go into is my diatribe about eating meat.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, no, I understand. I'll tell you what, there's a wonderful book that was written that makes all the arguments for you, and it's called, wait a minute. Oh, darn, I forgot the precise title. Oh. Anyway, there are several books that have been written by great masters about the defects, we'll put it that way, of eating meat. Karma Chakme wrote a very very extensive essay on it.
Maybe we should put a few copies of that book
in our library. Yeah, I think we probably
should. And in our bookstore.
Yeah, okay.
In our online podcast.
Thank you so much. You know, we got to be reminded. Yeah, you know? Oh, I remember. I think it was called the food of demons or something like that. You know? Yeah, I know. They really went for it. They really went there. Yes, please.
Hello.
one thing. The deal is, the reason it is looked down upon so much in many Buddhist circles is because those beings have Buddha nature and you're not letting them move along. You know, you're stopping them from moving along toward Buddhahood, and you're also accumulating the karma of killing, because you know somebody had to have a factory farm so we could eat this meat. So it's really very very difficult. It's complicated. But His Holiness the Dalai Lama, for example, could not give up meat eating because of his health. And so he says prayers because that's the only thing he can do, you know. That's all he can do is just eat what is prescribed for him by his physician and just pray and pray and pray and purify and purify and purify. So, yes, hi. Thank you for your patience.
Hello. So yeah. I'll preface first by saying that it was amazing that you talked about the 35 Confession Buddhas, because I was just asking around to connect with you whenever I could come into the shrine room anytime during the week to do the 35 Confession Buddhas and 108 prostrations. because I don't really have much of a shrine at home. So this would be a perfect place to try and do that.
Exactly. Well, you know, I really appreciate your aspiration, and I hope that it comes true. It relies on so many factors. You're absolutely right. Having a consecrated statue of the Buddha at your home would solve that problem. But there's many consecrated statues here. And so being able to, what my teacher told me was, he said that usually a small pill that has been either touched to or washed, you know, containing the washed fragments of relics is inside these statues. Relic pills are inside them. So he said when you make an aspiration or a confession in front of one of these consecrated statues, or the stupa out here, it's like making that in front of the Buddha himself. And it's got a lot of power to it. So until we have a staff that could provide daily prayer and meditation opportunities, because we don't have that right now. We have many people who are interested, but we don't have an organized structure for it yet. It's going to take us some time. I predict it will take at least a year for us to fully staff the things we have now, and then maybe expand a little bit. My hope is I wanted to start with a monthly 35 Buddhas, you know, prostration and recitation, at least start monthly and then keep expanding it as we can. Meanwhile, we'll see if we can't find a way for, you can come down and do your prayers, although it's really hard to do 108 prostrations on an incline, but if you wanted to do them here, you could do them here. You might have to stay off the public sidewalk because people will not understand it. You know, so even if you can't do 108 prostrations, even if you could just do three or seven or 21, that'd be a really good start. And you could recite right in front of the stupa here. It is permitted to approach it. And we actually have a couple of people who do this regularly anyway. They bring bowls, water bowls, empty water bowls, and they put the water bowls, and then they open a bottle of water and fill the bowls. And then they bow and recite their prayers. And then they take the bowls and put the water in the flower beds. And yeah. So until then, we have this for you. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Okay, yeah. This will be the last question. Morning, Chuck.
Hi, Lama Kathy.
Hey, good morning.
Yeah, I thought I would ask this because the question is popped up in my mind, and I also thought it might be of interest to others.
Sure.
The last couple of your talks, you have talked pretty freely and easily about prayer as part of our practice. And having grown up a Christian, you know, when I first got into Buddhism, you know, I felt some pride that, you know, I just meditated. You know, I really only did shamatha practice for a very long time. And more recently, in some of the other practices, the opportunity to pray has come up, or you've given
sure.
the instruction,
right.
you know, that has led me to do that. And gee, I found out I was still very comfortable praying, you know, like it's like, oh yeah, you know this, but I guess the basic question is, since our practice is not theistic,
right?
I mean,
right.
we say that. So what is different about
sure.
praying, you know, from a Buddhist perspective than
sure.
praying from a, you know, a more traditional or another religious tradition?
Boy, I really appreciate this question. My apologies for not being able to answer it fully, because if I were to really answer it fully, I actually have a set of talks that's called Prayer, Compassion, and Devotion, that where we just kind of go to town on it. Because I interviewed Kempo Kartha Rinpoche when I was given that topic. And I asked him, I said, well, what's the difference between what we might call Christian prayer and Buddhist prayer? And he said, well, first of all, he says, I'm not well read on Christian prayer. He said, so I could be making some wrong assumptions. He said, but if I understand it correctly, He said, in Christian prayer, you are addressing an all-powerful being who was never like you and who you could never become like. And you're asking for them to adjust the world to provide something for you that you don't have and give you something. And he said, so that's how I understand it. He says, I could be wrong. He said, but, he said, in Buddhism, you're praying or speaking to someone who was once just like you and wants nothing more than for you to become like them. And they want, and you're asking not for them to like adjust reality for you, but to inspire you to uncover your own Buddha nature. And you're asking for their help as you do that. And so that was his explanation of the basic difference between prayer in a theistic tradition and a non-theistic tradition. Because the Buddha, even during his lifetime, denied being a god. Because it was widely argued by some during his lifetime that he was one of an avatar of one of the Hindu gods, but he denied that. And when they asked him, well then, if you're not one of the Hindu gods, are you an ordinary person? And he said, I'm an enlightened person, which placed him right in the middle between ordinary and divine. So the way I see it is that in Buddhist prayer, I think Buddhist prayer is somewhat similar to the way prayer is addressed in some of the 12-step traditions of recovery that we're familiar with, where they talk about a higher power that has an interest in us and wants us to be sane, you know, to be healthy, mentally and spiritually healthy and sane, you know? And so that higher power idea, I think, is they're onto something, because there is more of that kind of relationship going on in Buddhism. Because in the 12-step tradition, they talk about developing something that they call conscious contact with the God of or higher power of your understanding. And I feel like that's what's happening in Buddhist prayer. We're making conscious contact with who the Buddha was, who he is, and what enlightenment is. And we're making conscious contact with that and saying, may I have the blessing of that. May I have what you have. May I have that peace of mind. May I have that sanity. May I have that goodness that you have. May I have that too. Because, you know, you have to say it to actualize it. And so even if we say it in our mind or with our mouths or whatever, we're approaching something that is beyond where we are now. And so that's, I don't know if that's, did that help? You know, is that, yeah, okay, very good. Yeah, thanks. Fabulous questions, friends. Thank you. Because of time, we'll have to stop here for today. But I'm so glad you were here for this. And I am not 100% sure whether I will continue with the Kagyu lineage path with my next talk, or whether I want to talk about just a tiny bit about holy or holidays, because we're approaching a Buddhist holiday in February. American New Year is celebrated on January 1st, but the Tibetan Buddhist New Year is celebrated on Tuesday, February the 21st. So you can make a note of it. We will be here, just as we will be here on Christmas morning, and we will be here on New Year's morning. And so we'll be here, you know, during the Western holiday periods. But we will also plan to do some special activities around the Tibetan New Year, because they say it's a very good fortune to it's kind of like the feng shui of time, You know, if you do things in harmony, that's the whole idea behind the science of feng shui, or, you know, harmonious arrangements. And so you can be in harmony with the times as well. So anyway, well, more about that later. So we'll gather together all the goodness that we have accomplished by practicing the six virtues: generosity, generously listening, being patient, you know, and so on. We dedicated to all beings freedom from all of the types of bondage they are under, and may they be free from that, and may they become Buddhas, and then may they benefit us all. We'll recite these words in English just one time through. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara. May we free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thanks, everyone. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling, or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.